Generally speaking, anytime you manage any folks, right, in any industry, you want to make sure you have the right team in there, the right folks, doing the work appropriately and accordingly. And again, in any industry, that's a delicate balance. And finding that, of course, it just depends, right, on a lot of factors.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I am the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle of managing your company spend without an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Corey Friedman, fractional CFO, and we're going to talk about a couple of things with Corey today. I have a particular interest in what some people call fund accounting. It's about how you manage the process of receiving grants, either from a government or nonprofit or whatever, and then how to distribute them properly, make sure they're getting aligned. And very interestingly, Corey has a cool story about how he spent a period of his career helping a client buy hospitals. Now, buying a hospital sounds kind of intimidating to me. I'm interested in the corner cases around that and how you go about doing it and what it's like to run a business like that. And we're going to have a chat about that today. So, Corey, you're very welcome to the show. Maybe you could start off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Yeah. Thank you, James. Thanks for having me on the podcast here. One thing I can tell you about me that maybe not too many people know is, like, I have become a big fan of doing martial arts, in particular doing Thai boxing as well as Hapkido, which is Korean hand combat. I've been doing that for a few years now. I enjoy it. It's a great exercise, great opportunity just to release stress and do something productive.
Okay, great. I am also, or let's say I was, a martial artist, right? And I always feel embarrassed to bring it up because, like, you think you do martial arts, people think that you're playing soldiers in the backyard or something. I don't know. It feels like too bro-y to bring up. But Hapkido, I've never heard of. You have to tell me a bit more. I'm sure lots of people confuse it with Aikido. I've heard of that. Right. So what's it like and why do you do it? I know why I love it. I think it's amazing. But what do you get out of it?
Yeah. So Hapkido, again, is Korean hand combat. So a lot of the work that is done is literally engaging your hands, you know, or someone. You can imagine you're walking somewhere and someone tries to attack you in some ways, right? With their hands, maybe they have a weapon. And I'm not saying this is what you should do or should not do, but, you know, at least it gives you maybe some hope if you have to defend yourself. Again, if they're coming at you, you know, they try to grab something in your hand, you know, a lady maybe has her purse and someone tries to pull that, like something like Hapkido might be of use to help kind of shoo away the attacker. And that's a lot of the principle behind it. Is like, you know, many of the martial arts, or all the martial arts, are it's a way to defend yourself if necessary. This particular one, again, it's hand combat. So, and that's kind of the notion behind it.
And can you spar? Is it like some of them are very, what do they call forms or, you know, and it's just sort of, I don't want to say this, dance. Some of it's just fancy dancing, right? Sure. And some of it's actually sparring. So how physical does it get?
Yeah, absolutely. It depends. Like, you know, you could be, or the attacker could be, you know, flipped over, or, you know, if you're talking sparring with like a partner in Hapkido, you and that person, you could be going back and forth with your moves. I mean, obviously, like anything we've seen, you know, on TV, mixed martial arts, UFC, similar, you know, you're trying to win, right? Or in this case, you know, with Hapkido, you're trying to defend yourself. So someone's coming at you, you know, you're trying to be safe, or again, defend yourself. And, you know, this is, so there is an opportunity where you may have to go back and forth with that person. I mean, again, we aren't thinking just like punches here. We're thinking, you know, various movements and stuff and being able to grip and gain leverage in a way, no matter what your body size is against body type or body size of the person that's attacking you. So it's to try to like use those points strategically to defend yourself. Again, even if the person's much bigger than you and such. And that's, you know, some of the working notion to the martial art.
The I don't know about how it is, but the embarrassing secret is like the idea that you're able to, no matter how big you are, you can defend yourself. It's only true to an extent. Like when
of
I
course,
was
absolutely.
Belt, I had a black belt on the judo map and there was this giant guy called Emmett. He came along, had a white belt. He was just freaking huge. Like of at a course. Certain stage, you know, I could You know, if you 6'8" and you're like, okay. Right. People don't tell you, but.
Of course. And of course, like, you know, someone has like a gun, there's only so much you're going to do, right? I mean, of course, there's limits to what you can do, but, you know, it's like any of the martial arts, it maybe gives you a chance to defend. Yeah. It's not a guarantee. Yeah. Maybe gives you a chance, depending on what that situation is. Not every, as you mentioned, it's not in every situation.
Yeah. Well, you know, hopefully you never use it. And it gave me huge confidence for myself. And mostly it taught me that there's actually always someone who can kick your ass. That's the thing. So better not to even have to find out if you can or not, like, for sure. All right, cool. I love it. It's a great pastime. I really recommend people. I feel like now it's a bit acceptable. It's okay to say you play tennis. It's sort of weird, a little bit weird sometimes to say you do a martial art, but we should bring it out, make it acceptable. Okay, so I joke with people on here, you know, we talk about, not here to talk about martial arts, we're here to talk about finance. And I like to have a credibility section at the top of the show. Basically, you know, why the hell should we listen to you when it comes to finance? How do you know what you're doing? So it's not, I don't normally say it as crassly as that, but let's face it, that's what it is. So tell me a bit about your finance background, maybe tell you your biggest career achievements so far. We can get a sense where you are in your career.
Sure, absolutely. So, my career for, you know, 25 plus years has been somewhat finance related. The first 15 years or so, you know, I worked for two large companies, great experiences in that time. And then shortly thereafter, you know, during the end of my run at my last company, started to get the itch to do something entrepreneurial. You know, during that time, the company was going through some changes. They offered people at my level a chance to take a buyout. I'd been at the company, you know, almost 14 years. I'm like, great, this is a great opportunity to start something new. As I mentioned, I started getting the inch for something more entrepreneurial. So I had a little bit of a runway after my time with that company concluded. And while I was trying to figure it out, apply to jobs, I started picking up these consulting projects, doing various things.
And what sort of finance training did you do? Did you get accredited, or did you go to college, or what? How did you work your way up?
Yeah, some of it's experience, where just as time went on, gotten better, and with my job responsibilities, got promoted, the kinds of skills you develop when you're in roles or certain roles, of course. And sometimes it's the things that's in the job responsibilities, and then there's the other things that you acquire through trial and error or finding things at work, as well as got my MBA from the University of Chicago. And I think that, you know, that better just to provide a more well-rounded approach to how I was just doing my work.
Okay. That's the great thing about working for a large company, an S&P company, is it gives you that ability to go and do development like an MBA or whatever. It gives you the scope. Right. Did they support you in that, or was that something you had to take a sabbatical for?
No, absolutely. I was going in the evening program. So I'd work during the day and then go to school at night. So like I had that balance between like theoretical and practical. And I thought that was a good interplay to really, on both sides, like anytime you go to school, they want you to develop critical thinking. And, you know, sometimes that was influenced by the practical work experience, you know. So they kind of helped each other, because I felt as if, you know, during that time I was bringing things to the classroom from my work experience, and then vice versa, bringing things from the classroom to work. And I thought, again, that helped me both ways, and I appreciated that experience. It was hard, no doubt, but, you know, it was challenging. And again, it was, you know, the overall experience. And I'm not saying there wasn't stress, of course, you know, still had to take exams and do projects and such. But, you know, the whole experience was very beneficial for my career, just thinking about things maybe I didn't think about prior to starting my MBA in the evening. And again, that interplay of the two really was helpful as I was going through the process and afterwards.
Yeah. Okay. So in the start of my entrepreneurial journey, one way to say it is that I started off with my then girlfriend, now wife. We were working on a business together. And one way to say it is that we started a business, we stepped out, we decided, in our case, we moved to Argentina to go and launch it there. And the other way to say it is, in 2007, everyone got fired, including us, and we had no choice. We had to make a living. So there's always some push and some pull. And when you decided to step out for yourself, how did you make the transition from corporate to, or what was the impetus to make the transition from corporate to entrepreneurial world?
Yeah. So again, during that time, my company was going through some changes and stuff. They were offering people at my level a chance to take a buyout package. And given I'd been there 14 years, again, I started to get this entrepreneurial itch. I thought the time was now. You know, my wife and I, we were expecting our second child. So I thought this was a chance to really go in a new direction. I want to be clear, like, it just wasn't a seamless change by any means. You know, there's a lot of new things. And, you know, especially if you're trying to start your own business, as many know, like, you're doing everything, right? You're responsible for everything. You are the HR department. You are the billing department and such. And learning that stuff, what that takes, being organized in a way is constant. And, you know,
was this business fractional CFO work, or was it a different business at this stage?
No, it started that because I thought I can lean on my finance background. I could read balance sheets and income statements pretty good, and try to, when comparing, you know, several years of information, you know, what's the picture that's being portrayed here? And as you know, it's like, you know, the financial results are the downstream results of all the actions in the company. So what's the story that's being And then that went from working with clients under the umbrella of working for companies to working for clients directly. And again, the process of learning of running your own business was one track. The other thing was, you know, what is the customer looking for? Okay, if it's to help interpret what the financial results are and craft that story and convey it appropriately to whoever the stakeholders are or interested parties, you know, that's, you know, something that was work. I mean, that's where the analysis was in some ways, what's going on. And of course, having done that analysis, what's the next step? Does that company make changes? Do they spend more here or try a new initiative there? That's one thing, again, that I really, you know, appreciated about like starting this is like, for example, like, hey, company ABC, you lost X amount of money. Your revenue is down. Okay, well, you know, what's going on here? And let's work together to try to, you know, again, craft that story, understand the underlying meaning. What is the action that happens as a result of, you know, what the track record is showing? And that's a part of, you know, part of the issues that kind of went into the work I started to offer. And as I try to get a little more seasoned with it, and I still am, you know, 10 years later, trying to always get better with, you know, what's the story, what's the opportunity, what are the challenges, and how does the company go forward?
So you had, so you're doing some bits of work for clients, and then one of them was doing something which kind of blows my mind what you would do, is like buying hospitals or looking to acquire hospitals. So that sounds like really advanced, let's put it. And when I think of a hospital, I think of these massive buildings and huge businesses and so on. And so tell us a bit about what this I always think of CFO and CEO like Batman and Robin, but I don't know who's Batman and who's Robin, but who's the Batman, let's say, in this case, what was he doing? And where did he even get the idea? I'm going to go around and start buying hospitals. Sounds kind of ambitious.
Yeah. So I consulted for a few companies that were in this distress space. And part of it is like, as we know, no matter where you are, like we all could or hope, you know, have access to reasonable healthcare. Hospitals, of course, you know, as we know traditionally, that had been like, I'm in pain, or, you know, my family member's in, you know, some kind of health trouble, I'm going to take him or her to that place, right? I mean, obviously, some of that's evolved, but the point is, like, you know, these places, you know, in the States still needed reasonable access to healthcare, or meaning like a hospital and such, if necessary. And having, you know, as you know, with a hospital, like, one thing that's nice is it kind of has, like, generally speaking, all these services under one roof, right? You know, depending on what kind of service is needed for the patient. So, you know, in consulting with these companies, you know, a lot of my work was looking at, you know, what is the opportunity to try to acquire them. And that also led into other areas like business development and such. You know, I would do some financial analysis on what is the opportunity. Again, if we were to acquire it today, what's been the track record in terms of looking at balance sheet, income statements, and such, and other key financial metrics that are important. And, you know, mind you, not every opportunity, there wasn't always an opportunity everywhere we looked, no matter how much trouble the hospital may be in. And of course, like the space is, you know, it's very difficult and messy. There's a lot of factors that go into play when deciding to go forward or not in acquiring.
Okay. So were these sort of family practices, like we might call it here, like, you know, it's primary care, like you'd have your personal doctor, and then he bolts on a few services around that, like, I don't know, liposuction or whatever, I don't know, like whatever, and then you're kind of trying to pull these together, like in a geographic sort of strategy, or was there a particular specialty that they focused on?
It was generally like the short-term acute hospital. So again, like your traditional hospital. Sometimes it was medical offices too that were connected in some way to the hospital. So again, you know, it all gets baked into that cake when you're evaluating, you know, is there an opportunity here? If so, okay, what either more information is needed or what is needed to move this forward or potentially with the hope of making an acquisition. And mind you, like acquiring didn't mean like hold it for the long term. It's, you know, sometimes a distressed hospital is, can you keep it open long enough where you can put in the right changes such that it can operate, or no pun intended, literally in, you know, today's climate. When we're talking reimbursement, we're talking, you know, addressing the needs of the community, you know, what that may be. And of course, like thinking about just all the different factors that go into keeping a hospital open. Obviously, you need your practitioners, you need the right kind of management, you know, you got to have the right kind of capital investments to make sure that the hospital is open and thriving. And, you know, the clinicians and practitioners are, you know, have minimal hindrance to being able to do their jobs. So ultimately, you know, serving or helping the patient get better.
So what does it look like, this sort of business, from a financial perspective? What are the big, what are the profit margins you might aim for? Is it like a benchmark, what a good, well-optimized hospital is looking for? Or were there like KPIs that you were looking for when you were seeking to acquire one that you could give you a high-level quick view on whether it's worth looking for into?
So again, like looking at like the recent history, like the, you know, balance sheet, you know, the financial position, you know, what's going on. Like anything in due diligence, you want to talk to the current management or current folks that are involved in the day-to-day. Hey, what's the story? What are the needs, you know, of the hospital? You know, because again, like so many of them are very capital intensive. Sometimes it's the building itself that needs work or the equipment that the hospital needs to operate effectively. So those are a couple of the critical factors. I mean, when it comes
to how are they, I guess a hospital sounds like one step up from a sort of professional service, but how are they valued? Is it on the fees or the revenue, or is it the EBITDA, or because there's so much capital involved, is the EBITDA more important, or is there a net profit multiple that people use?
So generally speaking, you're looking anywhere from 4 to 6 to 8 times EBITDA, depending on what that EBITDA is, of course. And then of course, there's many other factors that'll, you know, you got to weigh in there. Again, what are the capital needs? So what are the investment? You know, and sometimes you find that out again in just doing the due diligence, you know, whether it's, again, talking with the current folks in the hospital, the stakeholders and such. So, yeah, again, when I give those ratios, generally speaking, it's not necessarily that's what it is. But that's some common areas that are looked at in terms of evaluating or valuing the hospital.
Okay, so 4 to 6 times, I mean, that seems like not an outsized return, if you like. And so it comes down to, I guess, how much effort, like how much expertise you really need to run one of these. Is this where your partner came in? Like, did they know how to operate this thing, or would they try and buy it with an operator and operating team in place?
No, of course, like it's part of that evaluation and of whether to go forward or not is, again, what are the needs? And is it to staff up certain areas like that need help? Is it behavioral health? Is it oncology? And so usually when the companies I worked with or consulted for, again, as part of that is, okay, you know, they kind of use resources and connections and such to see where they could staff up those areas that need it the most. Okay. Of course, like, you know, like anything, you know, if there's good doctors there and such, and they want to be part of the next step, that's very much weighed into it, because of course you want to keep the good talent there that's, you know, doing good work and such as well. And hopefully you can build upon that by hiring the right folks that work well and complement the direction forward here.
Yeah. Like I was wondering about the people management side of it. Like if it's easier to buy a string of dry cleaning shops or having a bunch of doctors to deal with, like there's, you know, smart, intelligent people, you really must be tricky to manage, if you want to use that word.
I mean, generally speaking, anytime you manage any folks, right, in any industry, right, you know, you want to make sure, as best as one, as we know, tries, is to make sure you have the right team in there, the right folks doing, you know, doing the work appropriately and accordingly. And you know, again, in any industry, that's a delicate balance. And finding that, of course, you know, just depends, right, on a lot of factors. You know, sometimes it's, you know, the location, you know, in the example of a hospital where it's located. Okay. You know, if a hospital needs to staff up in certain areas, how difficult is it to recruit? And that may not be easy, to be honest. You know, sometimes geography matters. And if certain kinds of doctors are not located within a certain geographical area or geographical, say, boundaries where it makes sense for them to want to work there, yeah, that can be challenging for sure.
Yeah, I imagine. So let's talk a bit more broadly with another sector I know you work with, which is, I guess it's the charity sector or nonprofits. And you focus on that as a client, I think, if I'm not wrong. So what's your experience there in terms of what makes it different about working with a nonprofit versus a, I want to say, ordinary business, let's say?
Sure. So as we know, like any business, nonprofit, corporate, of course, you know, the challenges could be much more nuanced, right? Depending on what we're looking at. Nonprofit, generally speaking, you know, its typical challenges, of course, are funding, right? Or funding is one critical one. Got to have the dollars in to do the service, you know, and of course, it's got to be run in a certain way that makes sense, right? It's efficient, serving its stakeholders, it's carrying out its mission appropriately. Like we just talked about a moment ago in the hospitals, you know, it's got to have the right financial strength in there too. And again, like, you know, the great alignment, good governance, of course, are all key things that matter too in the operation of a nonprofit. Generally speaking, you know, financing or funding is usually the biggest issue, because usually, you know, there's a grantor or a corporate or charitable partner that gives maybe a certain amount, you know, over a certain schedule. If there's another organization that's not all that different in mission, you know, that same funder may say, okay, this year I'm going to give it to your organization, next year I'm going to give it to them. You know, then you got to go try to plug those gaps. And again, that's not easy. Again, there's myriad challenges to acquiring or getting the financing or funding that's needed. You know, as we know in the U.S., you know, there's been some changes here. So some nonprofits are, you know, trying to evaluate things and what they need to do to operate effectively going forward here. Others, you know, they've built up reserves strong enough where they can absorb some shocks to the system and, you know, still carry out their mission accordingly.
I had an interview with an organization. It was a philanthropic organization. And I asked them, you know, when you're giving out money to organizations to spend, you know, aren't you worried about how they're going to use that money? I was kind of self-servingly asking that question because, of course, we help people deploy funds, you know, where they've been gotten and make sure that the funds are spent according how they should be and so on. And the philanthropic organization said, well, actually, mostly our job is on the due diligence and on the upfront and getting to the point of granting the funds. And then after that, our job is done. We trust them. They go do it. Has that been your experience, or is, and to that point, like, is that a fair assumption that these granting organizations, can they be sure that once they're given the money, they're going to be used for the purposes for which they were intended?
Generally speaking, I'd say that's more or less in alignment, but, you know, some funders, there's certain sort of reporting mechanisms that are needed or compliance that are needed if they're a federal grant. Right. So that's important to definitely convey, hey, this is how we're using the money. This is how, or if it's provide, you know, reporting in, you know, some regular manner, it's okay. We're going to tell you how we used it. This is what's being used for, you know, and it's, again, it's got to line up, of course, with one, why it was deployed, two, and the overall mission of the organization. And sometimes it has to come in the documentation and communication you provide to those funding sources or funding companies and organizations.
So when you're dealing with an organization like that that's in receipt of grant funding, like, what's your go-to tactic for being able to answer that question if it comes? Like, do you just get invoices and receipts like normal, and or is there anything special you need to do?
I think a combination of things. One thing is, what can you measure in doing this? Like, if it's, hey, this money is to go towards the purchase of something that's needed to run the business, and maybe it's the funder provides 50%, the organization has to find the other 50%, you know, towards making this acquisition. You know, you, as an example, that funding organization may ask, like, okay, well, tell me how you're doing towards that project or towards, you know, acquiring that asset, you know, and I'm guessing, you know, that nonprofit would want to provide something of, hey, we are you know, 75% towards our goal of raising X amount of money for this. You know, here's what we've done. We've done activity A, B, and C. While we're still doing that, we're still able to run these programs and run those programs. And you know, here are some statistics or some information we could show you of like how we've continued to be successful, you know, during this time or during some period of time, whether it's the last quarter, the last 12 months or something like that. So it's showing or conveying or communicating to that funding organization, okay, you know, these people, they got their act together, you know, they're doing what they said they're doing. Here's how they're tracking towards that goal. Here's, you know, how everything at the end of the day all rolls up to the mission of the program or mission of the organization. And this is why we want you, funding organizations, still have fidelity in why you gave us this money and how, and of course, how it's been used.
So what I heard there was it's as much about your systems or your ability to answer questions as is what the actual answer is. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can't be, you have to have a clear, at least an answer.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, clearly and precisely.
Because sometimes it's the story itself, right? Like so many things, right? There's a story behind it, right? Good, bad, or otherwise. And it's like, okay, we want to convey the story of our organization and you as a contributor or grant making organization, we just want to give you some confidence and comfort and, you know, your money is being used in the way that we, you know, why we F or requested or sought it out or
you know, of course no one wants at that stage everyone kind of looks like an idiot if it isn't spent correctly. Like there's the granting organization, they don't want to necessarily know. It's not that they don't want to know, but they won't look good if they gave the money to someone who didn't spend it right. So there's an incentive there to for everything to be fine, unless it's egregious, I guess. I don't know what the, maybe I should get someone on from a granting organization to see how they feel about that. But I can see how, because their job is to give out this money. If they haven't done it correctly, then everyone looks bad. So you just kind of hope no one finds out.
Yeah. And it's like, there could be some positive externalities to both organizations. If, you know, one organization's providing money to that other organization that's using it in a way, again, that aligns with all the reasons why they got the money in the first place. You know, there's many incentives. Of course, naturally speaking, of course, you want, it should be spent anyways in the right way. But it's like, oh, okay, this company knows how to spend money effectively that aligns with the mission. That's great. Maybe we want to talk to them about providing funding to them as well.
Okay. All right. So let me just ask a bit about your own practice then. We've talked about nonprofits, which are good customers for you. Who else would be a good customer?
Yeah, so for however it came about, like, you know, the nonprofit and the healthcare route have found to be my most, where I've seen the most work. It's not the only place, but I've worked with, you know, other companies, some early stage, some technology, some education, some social enterprise, some other international companies. As well in doing a variety of this consulting work. So generally speaking, I'm more or less industry agnostic, but I have found myself to be working in these areas more. And again, on the nonprofit and healthcare side in particular, I try to seek those companies generally speaking, but you know, as it relates to finances, of course, you know, numbers are and finances and are somewhat democratizing, right? You know, revenues $5,000, expenses is $5,000. So by my math, that's, you haven't made a dollar, but you haven't lost a dollar either.
Very good. And cool. So people can, how can people reach out to you if they want to get in touch?
Yeah. So there's a few ways through my website, cffinancial-llc.com. You can also be emailed at Corey@cffinancial-llc.com as well. Be found on LinkedIn and such, and be happy to connect with a member and go from there.
Great. Thanks, Corey. So I have a final question that I ask every guest, which is, do you have a business hero and why?
Yeah. So I have to admit, like, I get into like just how organizations are run, you know, like why some succeed, why some don't succeed, and all in various stages of these businesses' life. So I think I've found myself like attracted more to the folks that have been really strong into like management, organization and such, you know, like a Peter Drucker, like a Jack Welch, you know, like a Michael Porter too, you know, when we're talking about you know, how do you, you know, how does your product reach your targeted customer? So those kinds of things I've always been fascinated with. And I think they've helped me again in thinking about just how businesses are run.
Okay, very cool. Well, there's some big names there, Peter Drucker, Jack Welch. I mean, they're the classics, if you like. What gets measured gets managed, right? That's my favorite. So thanks very much. And thank you for listening to the show this far. If you got this far, your special reward is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/mastermind. We are doing monthly CFO, fractional CFO masterminds. How it works is you come along, we put you in a group with three or four of your peers. You get to bring a business problem you're working on. So it might be practice development, or it might be a client problem you want to work on. That we had one last week, and we had a range of topics from how to grow your fractional CFO business to how to help optimize a service business for profitability. Could be anything. And if you want to come along, you'd be very well. If you're a fractional CFO, you're very welcome to come along, and I recommend it. We do it the last Wednesday of every month. Thank you. And yeah, this has been great. Thanks, Corey. Thanks for being on the show.
We appreciated your time today.